Welcome to the Impact of Blood Culture Practices on Antibiotic Stewardship and HAI Surveillance and Management podcast series, brought to you by the Society for Healthcare Epidemiology of America, SHEA, promoting the prevention of healthcare-associated infections and antibiotic resistance and seeking to advance the field of healthcare epidemiology and antibiotic stewardship. I am Patricia Pichilingue-Reto. I'm Assistant Professor of Pediatrics in the Division of Pediatric Infectious Diseases at Louisiana State University in Shreveport, and I will serve as today's moderator. Shay is excited to launch this episode where we will discuss healthcare-onset bacteremia. Healthcare-onset bacteremia serves as an important quality measure for infection prevention and hospital care standards. Reports from the National Healthcare Safety Network indicate a rise in these events during the COVID-19 pandemic. Identifying primary sources and determining preventability are crucial steps. Our discussion today will focus on effective preventive measures for reducing healthcare-onset bacteremia rates. I'm happy to introduce our speakers for today. First, we have Mark Rupp. Dr. Rupp, a past president of SHEA, practices adult infectious diseases at the Nebraska Medical Center, where he's professor and chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases and the associate medical director of the Infection Control Program. Dr. Rupp has had a long-term interest in staphylococcal infections, antimicrobial resistance and stewardship, as well as CLABSI prevention. And in more recent years, has studied the clinical significance of blood culture contamination and methods to reduce this.
Delighted to be here. Thanks so much.
And finally, we have Anna Sieg-Samuels. Dr. Sieg-Samuels is a practicing pediatric infectious diseases physician, an associate hospital epidemiologist at the Johns Hopkins Hospital, and she's also an assistant professor of pediatrics in the Division of Pediatric Infectious Diseases at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. She additionally conducts clinical research focusing on diagnostic stewardship and the prevention of hospital-associated infections to improve quality of care for hospitalized children.
Thanks for hosting this podcast on this interesting topic. Thank you.
Thank you both for joining us. As we all know, contaminated blood cultures result in unnecessary antibiotic therapy, resource utilization, and extended hospital stay. It has become a major focus of antimicrobial stewardship efforts. What is the clinical significance of blood culture contamination for both of you?
Yeah, Patricia, great question to set the scene. And clearly, this is a underappreciated aspect of clinical care. And an awful lot of clinicians just don't understand that blood culture contamination really is a big deal. When you look at the national data, somewhere in the neighborhood of anywhere from a 1% is kind of a low up to maybe 3, 4, or 5% of all blood cultures are contaminated. And although that doesn't sound like a big number, when you take, you know, a few percent of the millions of cultures that are done, it ends up being a really big number. And the data suggests that even now, in the era when we have antimicrobial stewardship programs and we have molecular techniques to very, very quickly identify likely blood culture contaminants, patients continue to still be put on antibiotics much more frequently than in patients who don't have contamination. In our own medical center, we looked at this, and people who have blood culture contamination here recently still are on antibiotics an average of about a day longer than they otherwise would be, and people stay in the hospital longer. Likewise, in our own medical center, we showed that people who have blood culture contamination stay in the hospital almost a day longer than they otherwise would. Now, this obviously results in antibiotics being used, which come at cost and toxicity and antibiotic resistance and C. difficile. Many times these patients get repeat blood cultures in order to show that the initial blood cultures actually were contaminants. And so that, you know, generates additional cost and resource utilization in our laboratories. And then there's the whole issue around sort of diagnostic confusion. So when the blood cultures come back and they're contaminated and a clinician falls prey to the fact that they think this might be, you know, the source of the patient's fever or infection, they potentially miss something else that's going on that could be very important for that patient. And then it sometimes prompts, you know, people to get additional radiographic studies or Somebody goes really wacko and decides they want to get an echocardiogram and show that they don't have endocarditis or whatever. So there's just all kinds of detrimental effects to our patients. And so that's really why this is an important topic to be talking about today.
Dr. Six Amos?
Mark really raised a lot of important downstream consequences of these contaminated blood cultures. In some sense, one can consider them almost like a false positive result. When the clinician first obtains that test, they're making that decision to obtain a test to assess a patient for bacteremia. So when they get a result that there's a bacteria present in that culture, I think a natural inclination as a clinician is to assume that's correct. That's a correctly identified organism that's causing illness in the patient and kind of act accordingly. So, in the case of a contaminant, however, that positive culture result is not actually reflecting bacteremia in the patient. And all those decisions made, based on that assumption really now are overtreating the patient or missing potentially the other cause in that issue of cognitive bias. So there really is a lot around here. And I like thinking about it as kind of like an infectious disease's false positive result and really thinking how we can minimize that risk of having these false positives for patients.
Yes, I agree with both of you. I think that, as you were mentioning before, just thinking about how clinicians wait for the results of these cultures, sometimes we don't have, rapid molecular diagnostics in some hospitals. So providers will be relying on, the Gram stain and then the significance of these blood cultures, and we will expose at least one more day of antibiotics for these patients. So how can we minimize blood culture contamination? And, there are several methods. One of them is the initial specimen diversion device, but I don't know if you have any other ideas on interventions that has proven to be effective in minimizing blood culture contamination.
Yeah, Patricia, again, a really good question. And, fortunately, people have been focused on this issue for quite a long time. And there's actually a large body of literature on how to go about trying to prevent contamination, because, again, it is a very clinically significant issue. And, I think one of the things that's really being emphasized now in our laboratory stewardship efforts is just trying to make sure that we're drawing blood cultures in the appropriate patients. I think we do way too many blood cultures on people that are going to be negative and, are not going to reveal a true pathogen. And if they're positive, probably are going to reveal a contaminant. And so I think one of the first things that can be done is just trying to make sure that you've got a reasonable degree of possibility that somebody might be bacteremic when you draw your blood culture. And so I know it drives me nuts when I'm on the consult service and I go by and I see a patient that, has chronic osteomyelitis, isn't febrile, doesn't have elevated inflammatory markers, but somehow, they got admitted for their osteo and people do blood cultures. I mean, there's like zero chance that that person is going to have a true bacteremia. And so I think, again, there are starting to be some real efforts to get people to think more critically and to draw cultures when they're appropriate, when there is a likelihood that somebody is going to be bacteremic. So, again, somebody with pyelonephritis or cholangitis or, some sort of a sepsis syndrome, absolutely, those people should have blood cultures performed. But folks who have a simple soft tissue infection aren't particularly ill. These are most likely not going to be helpful and are just going to drive up the cost of their hospitalization. So patient selection is the first aspect. Then once you've decided that that patient truly should have blood cultures, you need to do them very, very carefully. And this is another place where, again, education is paramount, trying to make sure that your hospital staff that are drawing cultures are doing this appropriately. And what I mean by that is they should just be using absolutely stringent aseptic technique as they go about prepping the skin, prepping the blood culture bottles, obtaining the blood, transferring the blood over to the blood culture bottles, trying to do everything they can to make sure that this is done in a way that will not introduce contaminants. The skin antiseptic that people use is important, and there have been some studies showing that using an alcoholic chlorhexidine sometimes can be more effective than some of the others. But again, if you do good blood culture skin disinfection with a povidone iodine type of antiseptic, you can likewise achieve very good results. Having everything that you need to draw those blood cultures in a kit A standardized approach is helpful. And so people don't have to go searching for what antiseptic to use and the various types of equipment or blood culture bottles or those sorts of things that they need. So having sort of a standardized approach and a kit can be helpful. Making sure that those people who are drawing the blood cultures are generally your phlebotomy teams. You can concentrate on training a smaller group of people rather than trying to have every single healthcare provider trained in doing blood cultures. It's really helpful to cone down on a smaller group of people and make sure that they're adequately trained and make sure that they demonstrate competency. As we've discovered in so many things in infection control, having good data, doing the surveillance, and feeding that data back to people is helpful. And so, we've certainly started keeping track of blood culture contamination, keeping track of who's doing those blood cultures, and feeding that data back to that individual and to that unit to let them know what their record is for blood culture contamination can be very helpful. Human beings tend to be a little bit competitive, and so they want to do the best they can. And so you can actually sort of have contests with your teams of phlebotomists and stuff to, try to drive that contamination rate down just as absolutely low as you can. I know one of the things that we're going to talk about in a little bit is, when should you draw blood cultures through intravascular catheters? And, there's certainly a fair amount of data to suggest that the hubs of catheters and the connector valves can become colonized and contaminated. And if you draw your cultures through the catheters, you're going to have an increased rate of contamination. And so there's many centers that are discouraging blood cultures from being drawn through vascular catheters. And I'm going to turn it over to Anna in a little bit to talk a little bit more about that. I know that there's some differences between adult patients and pediatric patients, and that's something that I think we'll have some additional conversation on. And then lastly, I know I've been talking a lot, but one of the things that we've studied relatively recently, and I think is a pretty exciting technique, is this initial specimen diversion device. And so the thought here is that when you draw a blood culture, when you put that needle through the skin, you essentially are doing a little tiny skin biopsy. And as you draw the blood up through the needle and into your blood culture vial, you're drawing those skin cells. And no matter how well you disinfect the skin, you also can have bacteria that reside in the sebaceous glands and in the hair follicles. And again, as you put that needle through the skin into the blood vessel, you can pick up some of those bacteria from those sanctuary sites. And so the thought is that if you divert that initial milliliter or 2 milliliters of blood away from the stream, and then after you've sequestered that first milliliter or two, divert the rest of the blood into your blood culture vials, that you will decrease your risk of contamination. And indeed, a number of studies have now shown that this can be a very, very powerful way to decrease your rate of blood culture contamination. We did a study a few years ago in our emergency department where we were able to get down to a contamination rate of 0.2%. So extremely low. And this has been duplicated now in a number of medical centers around the country, and I think is starting to gather steam as a cost-effective way to prevent contamination. And I would emphasize the cost-effectiveness because, again, as we talked about in the preamble, these cultures that become contaminated keep people in the hospital longer, result in a lot of extra costs, and when taken in composite, can be very costly. So decreasing them can be a real cost savings measure. And I've sort of used up all my time already, so I'm going to turn it over to you, Patricia.
Dr. Sixsamos, how can we do this, same prevention in children, right? We're having a really challenging population, small babies and children. So what are the ideas or the strategies that you have for minimizing blood culture contamination in these patients?
Yeah, happy to elaborate. So I think the challenges that Mark described are the same. We have all the same similar challenges, but there are some other considerations. When I was thinking about this question, avoiding blood culture contamination really is a diagnostic stewardship goal. We're trying to optimize the tests that we're doing to really deliver the right result and inform efficient and safe patient management. And so the first step is that decision of whether or not I need this test for this patient and how likely is it kind of that pretest probability that my patient has this disease, that concern of interest. And if there's really almost a 0% chance, then re-questioning, why am I getting this test? Is it right? Or are the results potentially going to be harmful for this patient? And so that concept of diagnostic stewardship is one that we do have some experience now in pediatrics. So the Bright Star Collaborative looked at this question, really building on some local work from the Johns Hopkins PICU, and some other centers have kind of built on this. But the Bright Star Collaborative found that providing some clinical decision support and kind of opening the door to saying a blood culture is not always necessary if there's not true concern for sepsis in this patient, and also reducing redundant kind of multiple repeated blood cultures from the same patient, just reducing those numbers, we can reduce overall blood culture rates safely without any impact on increased septic shock, mortality, or those concerns. And a secondary outcome that we learned from that study was also they saw reduction in CLABSIs. And that was an interesting finding because if you assume that the safety metrics really do reflect that the patients were safe, we weren't missing bacteremia events that were real infections, but in fact, we were missing those false positives. So patients whom there was not true concern for bacteremia, who didn't have a blood culture obtained, were not labeled potentially with a contaminated result, and also didn't ding as a CLABSI surveillance measure. And so it's possible that that's one interpretation of that data is we're avoiding some of those contaminated blood cultures as well. So that's point one, was the decision-making level at the clinician level. And then, a decision's been made to pursue a blood culture. How can we do that best for this patient? In pediatrics, there are some other challenges. Some patients are very small, and therefore we are very limited in how much blood volume we can get from them. So that is an issue that impacts our blood culture results. And also, these vessels sometimes can be very challenging to access. And having a wiggly, small vessel as your target could increase the risk of contamination just by nature of having a more difficult physical experience getting that venipuncture. I think we're kind of thinking about similar topics, but with the central venous catheters, that's another one where you have a patient who has stable access rather than inflicting more pain and discomfort or potentially risking other issues with that patient or even a patient preference. Sometimes central venous catheter cultures are obtained in children. One population that is highly unique to pediatrics is the NICU population. And I think in that particular population, this risk of minimizing blood culture contamination is a challenge. Mark, you mentioned at the end having adequate surveillance and keeping track and tabs on our contamination. Often the contamination definitions depend on having more than one blood culture for the patient. In these very small children and infants, they are so tiny, often not only is barely enough blood obtained to send a culture, but there's certainly not a second culture. And so by default, it's impossible to know if that was a contaminated result or not. Further complicating is the interpretation. Coagulase negative staphylococcus is one of the most common skin commensals that contaminate blood cultures, and it also can be a pathogen in this population. And so clinicians are faced with that clinical decision: does this coag-negative staph reflect true bacteremia, or is this a skin contaminant? And I have no other way to distinguish that. And so often these patients are treated for their coagulase negative staph bacteremias, and it's very challenging to distinguish contaminant from true bacteremia in that population.
I think it has been very useful that we, did a contrast of both adult and pediatric populations and the challenges of minimizing blood culture contamination. So, what are some other strategies that you can think about that are used to prevent healthcare onset bacteremia in general? Dr. Rupp?
Yeah, I'd be happy to tackle that. And Anna, I'll just start off by saying that I certainly don't envy the position of my neonatology colleagues and pediatric infectious disease colleagues as they try to interpret those results in our most vulnerable neonates. That is certainly a challenging population. The question around reducing blood culture contamination and strategies used to prevent healthcare onset bacteremia, I think, is spot on and something that we really do need to be concentrating on. Clearly, there are a myriad of reasons for patients to have healthcare onset bacteremia besides a catheter-associated bloodstream infection. And so, even though we do concentrate a lot on trying to prevent CLABSIs, we need to be also looking at all those other things that result in bacteremia and then trying to prevent those things. And so that's why this metric that is being introduced on healthcare-associated bacteremia, I am so supportive of, because I think it will really drive our preventative efforts to concentrate on all causes of bacteremia rather than just simply CLABSIs. And I know there are organizations that have really tried to get away from using central lines, using midlines, for instance, because they don't count as a central venous catheter. In some instances, you're just simply doing some cost shifting by doing that. And a person can be just as bacteremic from a midline or a peripheral IV as they can from a central venous catheter. And unless you are really concentrating and trying to prevent bacteremia from all of those different vascular catheters, arterial lines, central venous catheters, peripheral intravenous catheters, you really are doing your patients a disservice. So I think, that's why I'm really very, very supportive of starting this metric with healthcare onset bacteremia. But as I stated, there's a myriad of reasons why people can develop severe infections while they're in the hospital, and some of those will go on to be bacteremic. And so we really need to be preventing all those different causes. So surgical site infections, ventilator-associated pneumonias or hospital onset pneumonia, urinary tract infections from catheters or from other sources, all of these things can result in bacteremia, and all of them need to be addressed. And so again, that's the reason I'm very, very bullish on the healthcare onset bacteremia metric, because it will force us to look at all those different causes.
Dr. Sig Samuels?
Yeah, this is definitely a more inclusive measure. And like mentioned, it won't matter anymore what type of catheter is in place. But the important part is that really, when we breach those physical barriers, that skin barrier to keep bacteria out of the body, we put the patients at risk for developing a bloodstream infection. And so, any steps that we can do to reduce our catheter use safely, I think will overall contribute to that hospital onset bacteremia prevention as well. So, this is not just considering those centrally placed catheters, but also midlines, but also peripheral IVs. I think in many cases, peripheral IVs are placed almost just routinely or almost prophylactically, and they're left in place until the patient's ready to be discharged, for example. And so we might want to start rethinking some of those practices and saying, does this patient actually need this catheter of any variety in place at all? Is it still medically necessary? And removing all of these catheters as soon as they're no longer medically necessary and it's safe for the patient. So catheter removal of all varieties is probably our biggest thing that we can do. Early recognition of those hospital-associated complications, so early recognition of the pneumonias, urinary tract infections, and prompt treatment, cellulitis, decubitus, and pressure wounds, for example, things that can become more progressive and then lead to secondary bacteremia. And there's some that we can't prevent. So there's going to be some hospital onset bacteremia in severely immunocompromised patients, patients with severe gut dysfunction and compromised membranes, that the bacteria will have a chance to spill over into the blood. So we need to kind of recognize those situations as well. And lastly, basic hygiene. So this goes for just preventing all infections, but thinking about basic hygiene measures, making sure patients either have the opportunity to bathe or having staff have time to bathe patients, oral care, having patients brush their teeth, and supporting patients in oral care when feasible, linen changes and clothing or cover-up changes so that that environmental bioburden of bacteria doesn't just build up and then serve as an easy reservoir for bacteria to jump and infect the patient. So I think there's always this kind of constant that we can keep attention to those basic hygiene measures and really prevent all the infectious complications.
I think both of you mentioned really important facts, and I always emphasize, especially in children, I think that I'm really reluctant to put a central line in a child that doesn't need it. And then if they have a line every day, I'm asking, why do they need a line? I think that is very important in general, as well as, peripheral IV lines. So one of our last questions will be how or if we should be drawing blood cultures from intravascular catheters. And as we mentioned before, sometimes that is the only source that we have for blood cultures in children. So what is your approach, Dr. Sig-Samuels?
So in pediatrics, I think there may be more heterogeneity across centers and even clinicians in their practices. Mark kind of alluded to this, but there might be growing data that suggests having that plastic hub of a catheter allows additional surface area for bacteria to hide and then contaminate our blood cultures. And so avoiding that scenario and going to the skin that can be more thoroughly cleansed before we do that mini biopsy, if you will, is a little bit more reliable than cleaning the catheter hubs. In pediatrics, this is a challenge. There's lots of reasons that some folks might prefer to go for a central venous culture rather than a venipuncture. Pain is a big one. So, as a parent, I'm sympathetic. Having your child wriggle, scream, sweat, but you have to be restrained just to get a venipuncture is super stressful, both for the person drawing the culture and the child and the parents or caregivers. So, pain, discomfort, and kind of the trauma of it is certainly one consideration. Some patients, really, for example, an oncology patient, they really are not interested in any additional pain or trauma. And so, if they have an indwelling line, their strong preference might be to use that line for any of these blood draws. And also, just access. Like I mentioned before, children can be small, they can have small veins. And if they have a stable indwelling line that has nice blood return, that certainly might be a reason that people want to go for that central venous access for the blood collection rather than a new venipuncture. The third scenario I wanted to mention is we have a population of children that are life dependent on their central lines. So, for example, patients with bowel failure who are life dependent on their parenteral nutrition, their central lines are their lifeline. And so any possible infection of that line is taken seriously, even if it might be a false positive, if you will, or a contaminant and not reflecting true bacteremia. Their clinical teams might kind of accept that risk in the hope to preserve their lines as much and as long as possible. So those patients with these long-term indwelling lifelines, I think, is another population where we face a challenge of avoiding central line cultures.
Dr. Rube?
Yeah, Patricia, in adult patients, the answer is easy. It's yes and no. So, I do think that there are instances where you would want to draw blood cultures via a vascular catheter. And that's in instances where you think that the vascular catheter may be the reason that somebody is having bacteremia. And so, really, the only way to make that diagnosis is to get blood cultures paired from the catheter and from the periphery and to use the differential time to positivity assessment and try to discern whether that catheter is the source of bacteremia. So, we clearly tell our clinicians that if they're thinking that catheter could be the source of a patient's bacteremia, that we want them to sample the catheter and try to really discern whether it is the source of the infection. Now, if you have a patient with, a pretty clear reason for being bacteremic that has nothing to do with the catheter, and so a patient that, has a clear necrotizing skin and soft tissue infection or has obvious cholangitis or something like that, you really should avoid the catheter for your blood culture because, again, you're more likely to get a contaminant and to be led falsely by that test result. And so the data, although it's fairly old, is certainly consistent that catheters are more likely to be contaminated. And as we've already talked about, I think the reason for that is relatively intuitive, that it's easy for the hubs and the connector valves to become contaminated. And then if you're not really, really careful, you're going to pick up that contaminant with your blood culture. So if you do a blood culture through a catheter for the appropriate patient population, you want to use really good technique to get that culture. And what I mean by that is you should remove the existing connectors, because again, those are more likely to be contaminated. Very carefully disinfect the hub of the catheter, put a new sterile connector on that catheter, and then obtain the cultures either through that disinfected hub or through that new sterile connector. So you're trying to do everything you can to minimize the risk of contamination from that connector or from that catheter. And by doing that, you'll maximize your chance of getting a appropriate specimen. Just a few of the other things that should be done with blood cultures that I know this audience probably already knows, but make sure you get enough volume. And although that can be really, really tough in pediatric patients, obviously, for adults, you really do want to try to put approximately 10 cc's in each of the bottles, 2 bottles per set. So that would be a total of about 40 cc's of blood that you would like to get when you sample from that patient. And you obviously want to do your blood cultures prior to starting your antibiotics. There's almost no excuse to, start your antibiotics prior to getting those blood cultures. So that's just a few of the things. And then the last thing I would talk about is that when we have sick patients, many times they can have more than one central venous catheter in place, or they can have a multi-lumen central venous catheter. And then the question becomes, how many of those lumens do you need to sample through in order to discern whether a catheter is your source of infection? And that's a question that we're still trying to sort out. But I think most authorities would suggest that if you're going to sample blood from a catheter, you want to do it through more than one lumen. Again, some recommendations are you do it for every lumen, but that can get to be really a lot of blood and a lot of different lumens. Because again, some of these people might have, 4, 5, 6 different lumens that you would have to sample from. You're really starting to get into cost. You're starting to really increase your chances of finding a contaminant. And you get into the problem of iatrogenic anemia, quite frankly, because you're drawing an awful lot of blood from those people.
Thank you both for such a fantastic conversation. I don't know if you have any final thoughts, but we appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you. I'm delighted to have joined the group today and discuss this important issue. And I'm just very, very pleased that Shay is drawing some, important scrutiny to this issue that is really very clinically important. And we can do a lot to improve our blood culture processes and techniques. And, we've had a great discussion today. And I just hope that folks who are participating on the call will take some of this to heart and improve their blood culture practices at their own institutions. Thank you so very, very much.
Thanks again for bringing up this conversation. It's a topic that is important across age groups, across hospital settings, and really continues to be an issue. And perhaps more attention will come to this as we're talking about hospital onset bacteremia as a more inclusive measure that could include contamination as well, to that consideration of what kind of bacteremia we can prevent in our patients and how can we prevent all those downstream negative consequences. So thanks for bringing it up and thanks for the discussion. It was a pleasure.
You can find more educational content like this podcast on Shay's online education center, Learning CE, at www.learningce.shay-online.org. This concludes today's episode of The Impact of Blood Culture Practices on Antibiotic Stewardship and HAI Surveillance and Management Series. Thank you for tuning in.